All right. Thank you to that segment that was contributed by Josh Kiyoki. Josh Gaber-Doyon. Sorry, I'm sitting with Josh Kiyoki. That was with Cole Pauls. We're out of time for the show today, but for our unseated events listings, we just wanted to acknowledge that coming up, we have Fun Drive, which is CITR's biggest fundraising initiative. And we are looking for sponsors for the show for Unseated Airwaves. So if you're interested, if you're with an organization that identifies with the show and you want to help support us to do what we are doing, you can get in contact with us through our Facebook page at Unseated Airwaves or through Twitter. Or you can also shoot us an email at IndigenousCollective@CITR.ca. And we'll post all the info for the Fun Drive on our Facebook page and on our Twitter pages. Thank you to Mario Parent and Josh Kiyoki, as well as Matt Andrietta, for your contributions to the Star Wars Rogue One discussion. And thank you to Josh Gaber-Doyon for arranging that interview with Cole Pauls. And thank you, Josh, for board hopping today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I'm Lisa Gerbov, and you're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM.
How do you like your media?
Raw.
Spicy.
Free! I like my media semi-side up!
Shape your media just the way you like it by supporting CITR. Every year, we ask listeners, readers, friends, and family to support CITR by donating to our annual fund drive. It keeps the station running, and it helps us take on new projects. This year, CITR is looking to help our community shape their media by fundraising to provide new training sessions in current affairs journalism, giving creators new skills to shake up the media landscape. Thursday, March 9th at 12 p.m. to March 16th, we're opening up our phone lines old school telethon style. Call in during your favorite programs to hear about the special prizes each show is offering. You can support CITR and Shape Your Media by making a pledge. You can also make a pledge now online at www.citr.ca/fundrive. How do you like your media, John?
Spicy. Is that good?
Thank you.
Wait, hold on.
I think
Keegan also said spicy. Can I say something else?
Mm-hmm.
No, can you ask me a question again?
How do you like your media?
Well done. But that's not like what CITR is, more like a rare steak.
Hello and welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today I'm playing an interview that I just did the other day with David Hanscom, MD. He is the author of Back in Control, and I will explain all about it. He specializes in chronic pain. He's a spine surgeon, and many of his patients avoid unnecessary and scary surgery because of using the protocol that he goes through. But before we start the show, I just want to thank a listener. I want to thank Jeremy, who was listening to the show when I interviewed Penny Pierce, the author of Frequency and the Intuitive Way, and he dropped a copy of the book off here at the station for me. I just discovered it in my mailbox here, and thank you so much. He said he just randomly had come across this copy of the book and thought I would enjoy it, and just yesterday I was feeling like I wasn't sure if what I'm doing is really connecting with people or helping anyone. And so the fact that there was someone who not only took the time to write me a note, but came to personally drop off a book. Thank you so much, Jeremy. That is just so kind of you. And I just really, really appreciate it. It totally made my day. And I'm going to play the interview now with David Hanscom, author of Back in Control, and I want to send you lots of love. Have a wonderful day and enjoy the interview. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with Dr. David Hanscom. He is a complex deformity spine surgeon of more than 30 years experience, and as a practicing member of spine specialists at Swedish Neuroscience Institute, Dr. Hanscom's revolutionary approach to treating chronic pain has helped hundreds of patients live pain-free, often avoiding surgery of many kinds. And Dr. David Hanscom is the author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, Marie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So maybe you can
share with us a little bit about your experience, because you are not only a spine surgeon, but you actually have experienced chronic pain.
The book is written based on my 15-year nose dive into chronic pain, which started around 1990 with panic attacks, and I had no idea what had hit me. And then it spiraled down over the next 5 or 10 years into extreme anxiety, insomnia, ringing in my ears, migraine headaches, all sorts of things that now I know is called the neurophysiologic disorder. And what happens to your body's under stress and full of adrenaline, every organ system is going to respond in its own way. So it was miserable. In the last 7 years, I would say were extreme. And 7 years is a long time to be in extreme chronic pain. I had no hope. I was desperate. And I got extraordinarily lucky coming out of this hole. So the book is based on my experience. So the first edition is based on my experience and what I learned from my patients. Then the second book is based much more on the neuroscience research in addition to much more experience. So it's been an evolving process. I probably learned more the last year than I have in the prior 5 years. And it's exciting. I'm watching hundreds of patients go absolutely pain-free.
Awesome. Now, originally, Back in Control, the first edition, was more geared towards people with chronic back pain. But now it seems like, because you're dealing with the neurological issues, this is for people who are suffering from a lot of different types of chronic pain.
Right. What I learned is that the basic model that's now being validated in the neuroscience research, which really changed dramatically, is that every physical sensation is processed in a brain that yields a chemical response. In other words, pleasant sounds, feeling, et cetera, gives you reward chemicals like oxytocin and dopamine. Then when you feel relaxed, you feel the chemical surge. When you hear bright lights, loud sounds, pain, et cetera, your body secretes adrenaline and cortisol. Then your body feels anxiety. So when you feel anxiety, you're simply feeling the chemical surge. It turns out that anxiety is the pain. The problem that humans have compared to other living creatures who also have anxiety is that humans have thoughts that go to a similar part of the brain. They create a similar chemical reaction. And so pleasant thoughts give you reward chemicals. Unpleasant thoughts give you stress chemicals. And again, what happens, you feel that when you feel anxiety, you're feeling a chemical surge. The problem with thoughts is that you cannot escape them. And so this progression of thoughts throughout a lifetime is probably the basis for chronic pain. And then your body's on this sustained adrenaline attack. Because since you cannot escape your thoughts, your body's continually full of adrenaline. So each organ system now responds in this different manner. So at the worst part of my process, I had over 16 of these 30 symptoms. And so this book is much more about the whole process. What's remarkable is that as my adrenaline levels dropped, in other words, I learned the problems and the tools to calm down my nervous system and calm down my body's chemistry, all the symptoms disappeared. And I say that I've been pain-free for 10 years, except my wife keeps reminding me that if I quit practicing the tools that I teach my patients, my symptoms come back in about 2 or 3 weeks. Mm. So if I quit doing my expressive writing exercises, I will talk about a little bit later. The first thing that happens is these little skin rashes pop up in the backs of both of my wrists. My scalp starts to itch. I don't sleep as well. My reactivity goes up. My back starts to hurt. And my feet start to burn. So it's consistent. So again, the book is really for any type of any one of these symptoms drops down dramatically with the tools.
Thank you, David. And I just want to share your website, backincontrol.com, because I'm on the mailing list for your newsletters, and there's so much valuable information on the website, and it goes through the steps and the stages and gives a lot of information. And you even recommend starting the expressive writing, which we will talk about in a moment, even before people dive too far deep into the book. And I feel like that's because so many of us we love to gobble up new ideas and new information, but it's the action part that a lot of us are lacking in.
Right. What happened with my own experience is that in 2000, I read a book called Feeling Good by David Burns, and David Burns said to write. So I started to write. And of course, being a physician, I had tried absolutely everything to come out of the hole. and nothing worked. Within 2 weeks after I started this writing exercise, my symptoms started to change, and 6 months later, I was pain-free. I thought it was the book. It turns out the writing is the issue. In 1982, Dr. Penny Baker out of Texas did research on expressive writing, and there's been over 300 research papers now that document that expressive writing somehow breaks up these circuits. I feel almost silly being a major spine surgeon and recommending that my patients write, but there's actually way more research talking about how writing works compared to spine surgery. So I simply will not do surgery until my patients start the writing exercises, and I simply write down your thoughts and you tear them up. And it's remarkable.
So I'm wondering, David, I have a question about how the story in our heads becomes our reality. Do you think that's more important, or to jump right into the expressive writing? Where would you like to go first?
I think the expressive writing is the first part of it to talk about.
Okay.
And yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
So yeah, if you just walk us through that process of expressive writing.
So what happens, basically, philosophers have said for centuries that you are not your thoughts. Remember I said earlier how humans cannot escape their thoughts. What happens, you can separate from them. So I think, from my personal theory, is that when you write down your thoughts, thoughts are on the paper, and your thoughts are now separated by vision and feel, which is part of the unconscious part of the brain. And then remember the process with solving chronic pain is awareness, separation, and then directing your brain in a different direction. So the right increase in awareness and separation in one move is similar to meditation, where skilled meditators can become aware of their thoughts, separate them, and then come back to the present moment. The problem with meditation for most of us, especially people in chronic pain, is that it's just hard to do. So I call this mechanical meditation, which is to separate from your thoughts. Then I have patients tear them up instantly for two reasons. First of all, when you write things down, you have these issues that come up. My point is that they're not issues. They're just thoughts. So if you want to analyze these things, you've actually reinforced these pathways. So the writing is simply a separation process. And if you tear them up, you can write with freedom, and you don't analyze them, and you can simply start moving forward. So again, the writing is just a foundational step. It is not the solution, but it's the starting point. I've had essentially no patients get better without starting with the writing. If you never read my book, you never read my website, that one tool will start changing your life.
Beautiful. And you can go to backincontrol.com. There's a lot more information there. But I have some questions about the expressive writing. Now, you recommend ideally twice a day, somewhere between 5 and 20 minutes of writing, I believe.
Right.
Now, where do we start? Because you're ideally writing down negative thoughts, but in the latest article that you've posted on your website, it seems like new research is showing that positive thoughts, writing down positive thoughts help as well. So can you, where exactly do we start? If I'm not having negative thoughts that I'm consciously aware of, what do I start writing?
So I think the key issue is just thoughts, just free writing. And it can be positive, negative, rational, or irrational. And most of the research has been done with negative thoughts. But it turns out that when you simply write, it's a separation process. So I actually prefer just the word thoughts. And again, thoughts are just thoughts. That's it. They're not a reality. The thoughts are real because they create a chemical reaction. So the thoughts are definitely real. But what happens with thoughts is they get programmed and programmed and programmed, then they become, as you pointed out, our story, and they become our reality. So everybody's pretty much programmed by their past. You have all these patterns that are laid down, and whatever past is programmed into your brain, that seems like your reality and your baseline. But the only reality that there is you and I at this very second talking. That's it. Everything else is a story. So the writing, the reason why I say 15 to 20 minutes, there's no magic formula here. What I've had a fair number of people do is they're trying to write down all the thoughts during the day. In other words, they're trying to capture their thoughts, which in an odd way is a form of control. That doesn't work because there's trillions of thoughts in your brain and you simply can't control your thoughts. That's not going to work. So you have to simply write them down, tear them up, done. And then I say once or twice a day, maybe three times a day, maybe once a day. And for instance, I did my writing this morning, and it just changes the day somehow. I spent maybe 5 minutes. I'll do 5 or 10 minutes, sometimes 30 seconds, which is better than nothing. So it's not really a formula. It's not really a fixing energy. It's simply a separation energy.
So this would be separate from any journaling that a person might want to do. This is just getting this, basically getting the energy out of your body onto the page and then tearing it up.
Correct. And you don't have to cover all your issues for the day. And obviously people have an infinite number of issues to cover. So they're just your thoughts that are in your mind at the moment. That's it. Now, it's interesting the number of people that when they write things down, they do not want to throw the piece of paper away. And as one of my pain colleagues has pointed out, that if you're not willing to throw those thoughts away by holding onto the thought, you're simply holding on to your pain. And again, we just don't see that many people getting better at that writing and ripping exercise.
Thanks, David. So as I'm reading, now you have 4 main stages.
Right.
And then there's steps within each stage.
Correct.
And there's a lot to consider and to learn and to work through. And I'm just wondering, are people supposed to be taking time off work to do this? Or how do they balance this process and this healing from chronic pain while also living the rest of their lives?
Well, in an odd way, I encourage people not to take too much time with the project. So, for instance, stage one is simply the homework stage. And so by reading the book, looking at the website, step one is simply learning about chronic pain and understanding that it is a neurological disorder with a chemical response. And it's actually not that hard. Step two is the expressive writing, which is simple to do. The third step is called active meditation, which is an abbreviated form of mindfulness. We simply put your brain on a physical sensations for 5 to 15 seconds. That's it. So like right this second as we're talking, just feel where you're sitting. That's it. So what you've done, you've taken your brain off of the pain pathways onto a physical sensation, and your brain's now here. It's not over there. The fourth one is sleep, which is a basic part of the whole process. Then the fifth one, which has turned out to be very, very interesting, is people end up talking about their pain a lot. And they share with other people. They talk about it all the time. The problem is your attention's on the pain pathways. It's not connected to life. So again, you're inadvertently reinforcing the pain pathways. So stage one is sort of a foundational baseline stage. Really, everything I just talked about doesn't take much time. The second stage is around forgiveness combined with play. And again, once you understand the concept of forgiveness, you get to practice it multiple times a day. We're always in a victim mode every day. We always get frustrated every day. So they're just tools you practice on an ongoing basis. And then we combine forgiveness with play. And the fastest, most powerful way to come out of pain pathways is play pathways. And I realized about 5 years ago, my own personal journey is that this odd idea of work versus play is somewhat of an arbitrary definition because I love my work. So I just decided to have a better time doing almost everything, enjoy my staff, enjoy my patients, enjoy this conversation. And play pathways give you reward chemicals. You enjoy your life, as opposed to being angry and frustrated about your boss or politics or whatever you want to be frustrated about. That's not a very pleasant way to live your life. When you're constantly frustrated or angry, your body's always full of adrenaline. I use the word playful instead of the word play, because if you're obsessively playing to escape the pain pathways, the pathways always win. So that's stage two. Stage three is sort of a consolidation stage, which is simply getting organized and creating a plan of maybe 5 or 10 minutes a day of doing the process. And then the fourth stage, again, the concept is simply expanding your consciousness. So the ultimate escape from pain pathways is, I call it the spiritual journey of good food, good wine, good friends, thinking about the bigger picture of life in general. And when your brain's over there, it's simply not on the pain pathways anymore. And so as far as your time during the day, I actually encourage people not to take too much time. I'll go back to a comment I made earlier, is that you cannot fix yourself because your attention's on yourself. So when your attention's on yourself and analyzing and fixing, you're inadvertently reinforcing the pain pathways. I was actually in psychotherapy twice a week for 13 years and continued to plummet. I am a fan of psychotherapy, but you have to use it in conjunction with the other tools. So again, the process is awareness, separation, and reprogramming. And unless you do that awareness separation move, again, the writing is one way of doing that, why you really can't move forward. Mm-hmm. So it's like diverting a river into a different channel. So as far as taking a lot of time, this does not take a lot of time. I know it's a long answer to a short question. I hope that wasn't too much.
Now, you mentioned that after about 3 months of dealing with actual physical pain, your brain starts to rewire, and then that pain, there might not be any more physical reason for you to feel pain, but because your brain has wired itself to feel that pain, it's going to be there. But I'm also wondering about this adrenaline and the cortisol and that chronic anxiety that so many people of us are aware of. I've been trying to meditate more, and what I'm noticing is I'm getting almost to a panic attack level from the meditation, whereas I think that maybe I've had this low-lying anxiety all this time, but because I've been distracting myself with the rest of the world, I haven't noticed it. But then as soon as I calm down and slow down, I start to feel my body and I notice all of these things. Do you think that your years of working so hard in school, and there was challenges in your family as you were growing up that you weren't maybe so conscious of, do you think that that anxiety is what actually caused a lot of the pain?
So you just hit the bullseye, exactly the core of the whole project. So it turns out that anxiety is the pain. So what surprised me about 4 years ago, I had a series of patients that taught me that their anxiety levels on the questionnaire were very high, and they had leg pain, and they actually had surgical lesions that were ready to go to surgery. But the data says that if you operate in the presence of anxiety, depression, that the results of surgery are very poor. So I asked them a question and said, look, if I could get rid of your leg pain, but you had to live with the anxiety you're having the rest of your life, and it would probably get worse, or I could get rid of your anxiety, but you'd have to live with this current leg pain, what would you choose? And I was surprised that everybody wanted to get rid of their anxiety. They could sort of deal with the leg pain, even though it was quite uncomfortable. And then they asked me a question, well, if I got rid of the leg pain, wouldn't my anxiety go away? And I go, no, they're different issues. So it turns out that anxiety is simply a chemical reaction. It is not psychological. It is very powerful, very deep, very, very part of the survival reflex. And raw, unrelenting anxiety is absolutely intolerable. So what you pointed out in your conversation is that when you start relaxing and start feeling anxiety, that is the block to the progress, by the way, of people getting better, is that people cannot tolerate the anxiety. So for whatever reasons, I always urge people to go slowly. You don't have to rush into this. It's not a mind over matter thing. And so, again, you create an awareness, separation, and reprogramming. The writing does awareness and separation in one step. And for whatever reasons, the writing is a major factor in starting to actually drop down the anxiety. And I wrote a website post called The Ring of Fire, is that if you think of three rings, visualize three rings with the outer ring being blue, the middle being red, and the central one being green, and the central one being just who you are, connected to who you are, the red ring being the anxiety and frustration that we all feel, and the blue are those things that we do to escape the anxiety. So I was a workaholic, I was athletic, I did all sorts of adventures, and I was in this blue ring all the time in order to stay out of the red ring. The problem is you eventually get worn out, you sink right into the red ring, and you have to actually sink through the red ring to get to the center, because anxiety is part of living life. So the essence of the solution is you learn to become comfortable with uncomfortable feelings. Then as they lose their power, as you don't fight them or resist them, then they begin to lose their power and relatively quickly.
So just to clarify, David, there's a few things going on there. It sounds like you were this overachieving workaholic doctor, and in doing all that, you weren't even aware of the anxiety because you were doing such a great job of distracting yourself.
Yeah, I had no idea. So the first symptom I had of anxiety was a panic attack. So I went from no anxiety to a panic attack, which is a pretty big jump. I remember when I was 28 years old, I'd admitted a patient to my orthopedic ward with an anxiety disorder, and I didn't know what the word meant. I had to actually go to the textbook of medicine and look up the word anxiety. Well, what really happened, I was raised in a very abusive childhood, and my baseline core patterns were anxiety and anger, which I just thought were normal. I just thought that's what people did. So then at age 15, I sort of jumped forward and did everything you just talked about, and I was successful. And of course, a lot of my friends, they came from tough backgrounds, did drugs, which actually works quite well to quell anxiety while you're on the drugs. And we do a lot of masking behaviors to avoid that feeling of anxiety. In other words, every living creature has an anxiety response to threats. Again, humans have that same response to thoughts, and we will do anything, absolutely anything, to avoid anxiety.
Right now, we are speaking with Dr. David Hanscom. He is the author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. This is CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus in Vancouver.
How do you like your media?
Raw.
Spicy.
Free. I like my media sunny side up.
Shape your media just the way you like it by supporting CITR. Every year, we ask listeners, readers, friends, and family to support CITR by donating to our annual fund drive. It keeps the station running, and it helps us take on new projects. This year, CITR is looking to help our community shape their media by fundraising to provide new training sessions in current affairs journalism, giving creators new skills to shake up the media landscape. Thursday, March 9th at 12 p.m. to March 16th, we're opening up our phone lines old-school telethon style. Call in during your favorite programs to hear about the special prizes each show is offering. You can support CITR and Shape Your Media by making a pledge. You can also make a pledge now online at www.citr.ca/fundrive. How do you like your media, John?
Spicy. Is that good?
Thank you.
Wait, hold on.
I think
he can also say spicy. Can I say something else?
Mm-hmm.
No, can you ask me a question again?
How do you like your media?
Well done. But that's not like what CITR is, more like a rare steak.
Hey, Christine, try this donut.
Ooh, okay. It's so stale.
That's because it's 10 years old! The Dunkin' Donuts radio show is celebrating a decade on the air. We're having a big party to celebrate.
With a show at the Toast, Saturday, March 11th, featuring Two Bad Catholics, Supermoon, Maneater, and Gal Grayson.
There will also be homemade donuts and limited edition donut t-shirts. All funds raised go to CITR's fund drive.
See you there.
Hey, do you want some coffee to wash it down? It's from 2006.
Right now, we are speaking with Dr. David Hanscom. He is the author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. He is a complex deformity spine surgeon. And basically, this book is all about chronic pain and how, number one, many of his patients are able to completely avoid surgery in the first place just from going through these processes and doing this internal work. And number two, anyone who is going to be helped by surgery is going to have a far better rate of success if they're not chronically anxious and depressed to begin with. Is that accurate?
Correct. Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
So I was curious, as you read the book, I tried to make it as clear as I could that emotional pain and physical pain are the same thing. And it's a little hard to comprehend, I think. And I think by far the most rewarding part of this project for me is I watch people's anxiety drop through the floor. Then what the animal studies show is that as your stress chemicals drop, it actually improves the nerve conduction, so you feel actual less physical pain, because as the adrenaline drops, the conduction of the nerve changes and you feel actually less physical pain. But the most rewarding part is that people's anxiety drops, they go back to the workforce, we've had people get remarried, people come off very high dose narcotics to no drugs, no pain. But it really involves that whole process of the anxiety dropping. And so that's been by far and away the most rewarding part of this project is as we get older, anxiety tends to get worse with repetition. And instead of being creative and living a life that's expansile and enjoyable and relaxing, we end up with this endless battle against anxiety. and it just crushes us.
It's interesting, David, when you talk about how we make our lives smaller and smaller, and you mentioned earlier about not sharing your pain. And I just want to give an example. I have a friend who goes through a lot of health challenges, and whenever there's anything going on, when I speak with her, she will immediately launch into whatever discomfort she's having, and she'll go into it in such explicit detail that my body has a physical cringing reaction, and I will try to stop her and say, I can't hear this because I'm going to throw up. What happens is I call her less and less. What I imagine is that she is still talking about this pain with anyone who will listen, and they're probably talking with her about their pain because we are empathetic beings and we have mirror neurons. As right. soon as one of us starts imagining the pain of another, it's toxic.
Right. No, and you also reinforce the pathways. And so, again, you hit the nail right on the head again. And if you're open in the future, I just spent an hour podcast with a pain specialist in the South on family issues. And it turns out through the mirror neuron effect that the disability and chronic pain is actually a family issue. So as you share your pain with your family, first of all, they're helpless. They can't do much about it. They get very frustrated. Second of all, people in chronic pain are trapped and angry. They tend to use their family as targets, which is pretty brutal. And then the mirror neurons thing is a huge deal. So we hold a workshop. I didn't hold one last year, but I've done three workshops back at the Omega Institute in New York. And one of the ground rules is that you simply cannot talk about your pain at all. You cannot talk about your medical care at all, and you can't complain. And all you're doing when you do that is you're simply waking that part of the brain that's connected to pain pathways. So again, as you talk about your physical pain, remember, mental pain and physical pain are the same thing. You're just lighting up the same circuits, and of course your pain is going to be worse than as you keep reinforcing it every day while you're stuck in a pattern. Additionally, people in chronic pain, probably over 80% of them become very socially isolated because they start withdrawing. They do talk about their pain. People don't want to interact with them. And so, yes, you have much more time to spend only on your pain pathways. And so it's a very deadly spiral. Again, you picked that up right away.
And I also want to touch, David, on the point of that this is a holistic view, whereas a lot of times we think, okay, surgery is going to solve it, or the opiates are going to solve the pain, or the physiotherapy, or whatever it is. But you say again and again how important it is to target all of these things at once. There's not just one solution.
Right. I mean, one of my goals, I've started a national campaign on the word just listen. And doctors right now don't have the time to take the time to listen to their patients, although they want to. I mean, when doctors get a chance to talk to their patients, they enjoy it. But you have to understand the whole picture. And one of my goals is to take that word holistic out of medicine, and also alternative medicine, or because this is medicine. This is basic medical care. Whether you're in alternative medicine or regular medicine, you're looking at sleep, stress, physical conditioning, diet, exercise. This is basically primary care. And so I would like to see the word holistic medicine disappear, because it should be just standardized medicine.
Thank you. Well, I think the point I was trying to make is that people think that people are looking for the one solution, the one thing that's going to fix them. And it's not just one thing. You have to take all of these things into account.
Correct. So the metaphor I use, I think you saw on the website, is fighting a forest fire. It takes multiple strategies to fight a forest fire. All of them count. All of them contribute. So with chronic pain, sleep makes a difference, maybe 25%. Stress management, maybe 25 to 30%. Physical therapy could be another 10 or 15%. Acupuncture, another 10%. So when you start adding these modalities together, at some tipping point, people go to pain-free. When you do one at a time, it essentially never works.
So I think that this is part of the stages you mentioned. The moving forward part is figuring out how to fit all of this into your life and making it a balanced priority.
Right. So this is stuff that's ongoing. I get to probably practice this all day, every day. So stage two is where a lot of action takes place, which is forgiveness. And Anthony DeMello wrote a book, which I now pull into my practice, called A Way to Love, which he actually uses the word love for the word awareness. And his solution, which I think has a lot of merit to it, is simply becoming aware. So when you're anxious, you become aware of what made you anxious. When you have these stories in your head that upset you, you ask yourself the question, is this story really true? When you get angry at somebody or label them, again, his solution is awareness. So it doesn't, again, take a lot of time to fit this in. And it's just sort of day-to-day life. You have good days and bad days. And so you learn when you're triggered, and then you take a deep breath, and you can come out of the hole within a minute or two. Sometimes for me, it's a day or two. And so it's just sort of a day-to-day, minute-by-minute experience that becomes just a learned skill with repetition.
One of the things that I noticed last night, I had a tough night emotionally. I've been dealing with depression for the last couple of months, and and I know all the things that I'm supposed to do. I know that I can distract myself. I know that I can change my physiology, change the way I'm standing or the facial expressions that I'm making. But last night, the negativity that I was in, I didn't want to do those things. I just wanted to curl up into a ball and tell everyone to go away and just disappear, even though I knew that that was only going to make me feel worse. That was what was driving me. I had the thought of, oh, I could get up and do this. I could do something nice for myself. I could put a half smile on my face to change my physiology. But I didn't want to do that. I was just willfully like, no, I want to be miserable.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
So what happens, there's a genealogy of anger where you have a circumstance that you blame, then you're a victim, and then you're angry. And what happens with depression is that what drives depression is anger-driven anxiety. And I was depressed for 15 years with a major depression. And again, I tried everything, medications, counseling, the whole thing, and just kept getting worse. But depression to me is just a constellation of symptoms driven by anxiety. So the first sign of depression is that you wake up in the morning, can't go back to sleep. That's anxiety. Then you can't fall asleep, which is also anxiety and racing thoughts. Then you can't concentrate, which is a combination of racing thoughts and lack of sleep. And right there, you have a depression. So to me, depression is just a constellation of symptoms driven by anxiety. So when I go back into my depression mode, invariably, it's around anger. And you're right that when you're in victim mode, you don't want anybody to touch you. And by definition, you do things that are self-destructive. Because remember, anger is destructive, including self-destructive. So you're right, it's a complete package. It's that you're depressed, you're victim mode, and then you know what you should be doing, but since you're in victim mode, you're not going to do it. So I know this routine better than any human being alive. So what you're going to do is you learn to be okay being depressed. You'll find yourself start to pull out of it in an odd way. And I can tell you for me personally that the victim role is very powerful. Nobody really wants to give it up because it's so powerful. And the fastest way to pull myself out of the depression is to simply say, no, done. I'm not going to be a victim. The problem with being a victim is so powerful, you're never going to wake up one morning and say, I don't want to be a victim anymore, because it's just always there. You'll never want to give it up. So that's the one part of the process where you simply say, I'm not going to be a victim. And my patients often do an exercise where I have them sit in the room. I ask them not to leave until they're ready to get out of the chair and say, I'm not going to be a victim. So it might take 5 or 10 minutes. It may only last 5 or 10 minutes. And you might go right back into the victim mode. That's fine. But you learn to be okay being depressed. You become aware of all the circumstances around it. And if you try to use meditation, mindfulness, distractions to solve the depression, again, the unconscious brain is a million times stronger than the conscious brain, and you cannot win it. So what the writing does in an odd way, it pulls you more into depression, more into the anxiety. There's a term now being used called leaning into the negative. So as you become aware of what's pulling you into the hole and you separate, then you can redirect. Am I saying a lot here? Am I making sense with all this?
I think so. So with the writing, because that is a concern. I mean, we talk these days about not focusing on the negative, focusing on the positive. And I imagine getting up, let's just say I get up in the morning and I start my writing and I'm writing, I really feel like crap today. I didn't sleep well. You know, I feel like I'm too fat and whatever judgments I'm having about myself. I mean, if that's the way I'm starting my day, how productive am I going to be?
Remarkably productive. So here's the thing. You made a comment that's really key to this whole conversation, but does not work in chronic pain or anxiety is positive thinking. It just doesn't work. In fact, it's deadly. In fact, there's a whole bunch of literature now on thought suppression that when you suppress thoughts or emotions, it actually damages the hippocampus of your brain, which is the memory center. So we also think that thought suppression is the link to opioid addiction. So suppressing thoughts and emotions is actually deadly for both physical and mental health. So what you're doing when you're writing, simply writing what's there. And again, it's a process of gradually learning to be comfortable with these other negative thoughts because they're there. You can't get rid of them. It's part of your nervous system. It's part of your programming. It's part of being a human being. So the writing is not the solution. So positive thinking doesn't work, but positive substitution is a big deal. So you become aware that so you can't substitute though until you become aware of what is. So with awareness, you can now separate and then redirect. So again, going back to the early part of the conversation, the unconscious brain is 1 million times stronger than the conscious brain. If you're using positive thinking to deal with this massive unconscious force, it's like trying to take down Mount Everest with a pickaxe. You can't do it. So that's where the positive thinking is actually one of the most deadly things that's been put on our human experience. It doesn't work. It just does. In fact, I wrote several articles called The Dangers of Positive Thinking. But the research is clearly showing that positive thinking is sort of a disaster.
Hmm. So suppressing those negative thoughts makes them worse.
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursday 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Right now, we are speaking with Dr. David Hanscom. He is the author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. So suppressing those negative thoughts makes them worse.
Absolutely. In fact, they call it a trampoline effect. In 1987, they did an experiment called White Bears, where they asked people not to think about white bears. And of course, people thought about them more, but they've thought about them a lot more compared to people who weren't put through the experiment. So there's a huge trampoline effect. When you suppress negative thoughts and emotions, you actually reinforce them dramatically.
One of the things that I noticed last night that came out, I was talking, maybe I shouldn't have been talking about it with my boyfriend, but I was talking about how I was feeling. And the thought that I had was that I was bad. And I'm wondering how common that is for people with chronic pain and anxiety.
Well, it's universal in the human experience, which is interesting that everybody has anxiety and everybody wants to pretend that they don't. So then remember, your brain's automatic response to stress is always survival, is always adrenaline, is always anxiety. So my friend Luskin, who wrote the book Forgive for Good, pointed out that the human body is not designed to have a good time. It's designed only to survive. So for whatever reasons, people suppress negative thoughts, which makes them stronger. Every human being I've talked to, and I get to see everybody, talk to everybody, is that this is universal. So remember, it's just a thought, right? So the writing, you simply write down, I'm bad. You can put down way stronger words than that. And again, you're not looking for a solution. You're simply putting down thoughts. Because remember, thoughts are only thoughts. They're just thoughts. So if you try to analyze them and fix them, you inadvertently reinforce them. I remember one day, I also read a website post. Did you read the website post called She Just Let Go?
No.
It's a story of some, yeah, there's a, it's just the whole process. You sort of, my wife hates it when I use this word, but you sort of give up. So you have all the stuff in your head you're doing battle with. You can't win. And so all things, you just relax and enjoy the conversation you're having in front of you. Then you watch the bad thoughts come through your brain, and you start to learn to separate from those. And again, the writing seems to be a key issue in breaking up these circuits, but you just sort of give up in a way. You quit. I wrote another website post called Solving the Unsolvable. So if you realize that these thoughts and issues in the past are unsolvable, all the energy you spent trying to solve these thoughts disappears, and your energy goes towards creating a new life. So as you start moving forward, you start reconnecting with the creative part of your brain, including play, then your brain starts to develop that direction, and we now know that the brain actually physically changes structure. We actually create new pathways.
Interesting. So just letting go of it, that's part of what it is writing it down and then letting it go.
Yep. That's why it's so critical to tear this up, shred it, burn it. Don't crumple it. You know, crumpling means somebody could find it. So you want to write with absolute freedom. And I would say half my thoughts are negative, irrational, half of them are positive, sort of grandiose. It doesn't matter. And so, again, the trap people get into with their writing is that these thoughts come out, they identify with their thoughts, they want to solve these and analyze these. I say, look, it's like putting your hand right into a hornet's nest because your attention's on yourself. You can't fix yourself because your attention's still on yourself. So as you separate and then you put your brain towards life, people, friends, family, it simply starts to develop that direction. I mean, so this is a very interesting interview with you because you really have brought out these issues in a way I've not really seen brought up before in an interview because you've been very open, which is great. But it's okay being depressed. It's okay being negative because that's part of who you are and who we are, all of us. So it's just sort of, I hate to use the word accept because that's not right, the right word. It just is. So if you fight the depression, you just wear yourself out. You sort of let the depression be, watch yourself act. You'll eventually get out of bed. You'll start doing things that you want to do. You'll call your friends, and your brain will start moving in a different direction. But it's when you quit that fight that things start to happen. Yeah.
So, David, I feel like as soon as we become aware of these thoughts, like with the thought of being bad, the first instinct is to figure out, why do I think that? Where in my childhood did I get that idea that I'm bad? And what do I do about it? How do I solve it? And you're saying just let it out. We all have these thoughts. It's part of the human condition. And then tear it up so that, and that's the way that you're becoming aware of the thoughts, and the tearing it up and letting it go is the separation.
Right, because you can't fix them. I remember the past is done, over, can't fix it. Plus, we have trillions of thoughts, not billions. We have trillions of thoughts in our brain. So you can't fix all these things. So whatever surfaces, you just write it down. They are permanent pathways. They're permanently embedded in your brain. So the same thought may come up 10 different times. I have some thoughts come up today I haven't had for 15 years. So they're just there. And so I did my writing this morning. I did some writing this afternoon. I had a couple things that triggered me a little bit. So I just did a little bit of writing. And I'm fine.
Yeah, I think that a lot of us have these thoughts like, oh, if I had a dream that I did something in my dream that's not the usual, does that mean something about me? Does that mean that I have these deviant parts of me? And we start to identify with these thoughts because we're so worried about it.
Well, the key is you use the word identify. So identifying with the thoughts is really difficult. I mean, it's really a problem. But remember, the human body is designed just to survive. Everybody has survival thoughts. They're not pleasant thoughts. They're not nice thoughts. It's part of the human experience. We're designed to survive, not to have a good time. We're not designed to get along with people. In the human experience, the reason why people get along and have empathy, etc., is that the species that could get along and cooperate had a higher chance of surviving. But dinosaurs are 165 million old, at least 165 million years old. That's the survival part of our brain that's still there. Human consciousness is less than 20,000 years old. So we're still dealing with this dinosaur reptilian brain that's this massive amount of force that we can't control. And once you sort of, again, let that go, you can guide it. In other words, again, positive thinking doesn't work, but positive substitution, directing your attention towards where you want it to go, makes a huge difference. So, as you, I mean, your brain will develop wherever you place its attention. So again, if you're trying to fix yourself, your attention's on the pathways. If your attention's towards good food, good wine, good friends, again, not positive thinking mode, but simply positive substitution, your brain actually starts to physically change.
Can we talk just for a moment? I know we have to wrap up in a few minutes, but a little bit more clarification on the difference between positive substitution and positive thinking.
Let me think about how best to say this. The thing about pain pathways is that they are permanent, and positive thinking is simply a way of suppressing a negative thinking. For example, in my questionnaire, respond questionnaire to rank people in anxiety, depression, and in irritability, which is anger, if somebody says, I have none of that, I can't help them. I essentially get none of those people better. I just talked to a gentleman this morning who has been working with my website for a year, and he's not gotten better. And he has pretty severe pain. So I said, look, are you doing the writing? He goes, yes. I'm doing the relaxation meditation. I go, fine. But I said, have you dealt with anger issues? And he said, no. He says, I had an abusive background. I don't want to be angry. So I'm not going to be angry. So it's extreme substitution. I mean, I'm sorry, it's extreme suppressing of a lot of built up anger. So even though he isn't consciously connected to the anger, his body is. So he has terrible back pain, terrible chest pain, lots of physical symptoms because his body is still full of adrenaline. So even though he's not connected to it, we call the word dissociating, that's an extreme form of positive thinking or suppression. With positive substitution, you just simply experience what's in front of you. And you make a choice to have dinner, talk to a friend, again, the first step is the mindfulness meditation. I make a decision to live my life with a sense of playfulness. So I used to go to work and be frustrated about politics and all sorts of things going on. There's plenty to be frustrated about in medicine these days. But I decided just to have a good time. I'm going to have a good time. I'm going to enjoy my patients, my staff, my friends. And our clinic we just have the best time ever in our clinic. So play pathways are the most powerful way to come out of the pain pathways. In this one omega seminar that we put on, we had 80% of our patients going to pain-free within 5 days. And what happened is my wife is a tap dancer who started teaching us these hand rhythms. And as people started to laugh, I mean truly laugh, within 24 hours, the pain disappeared. So again, the positive substitution was play. It wasn't thinking positive thoughts to deal with negative thoughts. Is simply play. So the thoughts are still there. The past is still there. Nothing's changed, except now in the present moment, you have a sense of play. Does that help?
It does. And you mentioned politics and your frustration with the medical community. So if maybe we can use an example. So let's say that you see some headline in the news that is justifiably upsetting.
Right.
What's kind of a thought or behavioral process that you go through? So you see this headline, you feel the reaction in your mind and in your body. Then what's next?
So Fred Luskin points this out really clearly in his book called Forgive for Good out of Stanford. And his point was, if you get upset about something you have no control over, you're wasting your time. It's also another way of remaining in the victim mode. In other words, I have patients who are just upset about world hunger. They're upset about ISIS. They're upset about the Taliban. I get it. I mean, there's nobody more upset about that than myself. The problem is when you get upset about something you have no control over, you're in a victim mode. And it's sort of a way of permanently remaining in the victim mode. So you don't have to like the headlines. You don't have to like ISIS at all. In fact, you can despise them. But you realize you have no control over it. It does not make sense to stay physically upset over something that they have no control over. So you write it down, you understand its effect is having on you, and then you do what you can right in front of you to make the world a better place. I think a metaphor that hit me hard years ago was, there's a book called on Taoism. It's called 365 Tao. And the metaphor he used was a stork standing in a quiet pond. And when a fish came by, he would just reach down, pick up the fish, and have his lunch. The message being, you're really only responsible for what's right in front of you. And so the stork wasn't flying over the lake trying to find fish. He was just standing there waiting for his fish to come by. So each one of us has a responsibility to take care of ourselves, take care of our family, take care of our friends, be as socially active as we can. Sometimes we can't. That's fine. But the first responsibility is to stay connected to yourself and remain aware and be that one positive contribution to the conscious, you know, the collective consciousness to make the world a little bit better place. A lot of people, you know, they're trying to save the world in order to save themselves. And I would have to put myself in that category historically. Some days I still do. But the reality is, the first person you have to take care of is simply you. That's your responsibility.
Thank you so much, David. Again, we have been speaking with David Hanscom. He is the author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. You can find his book wherever books are sold, and you can also go to his website and sign up for his weekly insights at backincontrol.com. Such a wealth of information on that website as well, backincontrol.com. David, what would you like to leave us with today?
I just want to tell people that chronic pain is a solvable problem, specifically anxiety. It's if you find yourself not willing to go through the process, then the anger that goes along with the anxiety is actually blocking you. So I'd ask you simply just to start engaging the tools. So simply, if you do nothing else, let's start the simple writing exercises. And just simply watch what happens. And it's the simplest thing ever. And just watch what happens. So I'd urge you to do that. But chronic pain is an incredibly solvable problem that up to this point in time has been considered unsolvable.
Beautiful. That's so impactful. Thank you so much for your time, David. And thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. I want to send you lots of love. Be well. Namaste.
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Dave Radio, Fridays at noon on CITR.
Wow, wow, Dave, you're so sway. Oh, Dave, I like your shave.
Having trouble finding affordable fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe, located in the McMillan Building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
Just anybody. Help. You know I need someone. Help. When Do you ever feel uncomfortable or unsafe walking around campus at night? There's an AMS service dedicated to helping anyone trying to get across campus alone at night. We're SafeLock, and we have your back. Call us at 604-822-5355 to request a transfer, or check out our website.